Good morning, everybody. You're about to listen to a really wonderful and thorough interview with James Mooney, founder of the Oklava Native American Church in the United States. And there's a lot of different things that James covered in this interview. When I approached him about it, I sent him a list of questions, and he said, those sound great. And the first question that I asked him was one that he felt really good about talking about and sharing. I just wanted to kind of offer that as an initial disclaimer, because as I was doing the editing, I was thinking to myself, someone might find it kind of strange that that's the first question that you ask someone in an interview. But just as a, like I said, a disclaimer, I had sent a list of questions to James prior to the interview, and he felt good about them and he wanted to speak about them. And what I really wanted to do with this interview is give James just a full license to share about his whole past history, about his ethnicity, which, as he shares, was something that was challenged in a court of law, and the back history as to how he came to do traditional ceremonial work and then create the formation of a church, and the struggles of the oppression that he went through in helping to make ceremonial medicine work available to people and to bring it out to different cultures from just the traditional way. And in this interview, Jim shares really personal information about his life from a really young boy and how that shaped his later years as an adult and the relationships that he met and the challenges that he went through. And it's a really beautiful story and it's really powerful. And then later in the interview, I love how he shares about kind of the back history of Native American culture and its relationship to the United States government and the culture as a whole. It's a really powerful back history, and I just wanted to share a little bit because so much of the stuff that he shares about is stuff that people don't talk about too much in the culture here. I think so many people were raised looking at Christopher Columbus as a hero. There's so little talk about the genocide that indigenous and Native American people went through at the hands of the U.S. culture. And I think it's a really powerful reminder that this country was founded on genocide. This country was founded on imperialism. This country was founded on slavery. And it's always important, you know, people say we need to know our roots. And James's story is so much about roots because his culture being Seminole and how that is been twisted and convoluted by people who were trying to attack him for the work he was doing with Oklava. And it's this thing, right? Everyone always says, go back to your roots, go back to your roots, who you are. And I think it's really essential that as a culture and a country, the United States soberly looks at its roots and where things were founded and why things were founded, because so often, more than not, almost all the time, so many things were created to essentially degrade, oppress, and exterminate people of different cultures, different races. And I just think the history that James shares, although in a lot of ways it's very brief, it's really powerful, and I think it's really important that people hear it and listen to it, especially if you don't have a strong back history of Native American culture. I would recommend to people, if you're interested in what James is talking about, to do your own research about a lot of the things that occurred. I would highly recommend reading Leonard Crow Dog's book called Crow Dog, Four Generations of Sioux Medicine Men. The book is amazing. It's super powerful. Leonard Crow Dog actually died on June 6th of last year, so I think it's a really important time, perhaps, to go back to look at what he was sharing and what the Lakota people and all Native American people had to endure at the hands of the U.S. government and are still enduring at the hands of the U.S. government and the culture as a whole. So I would really encourage people to check that book out. I read it several years ago. It's very powerful from start to finish, and to understand even more the back history, going back even farther than Crow Dog, I highly recommend reading Black Elk Speaks. And there's so much I could talk about with that book, but it's one of the most profound books perhaps ever written in a lot of ways, where it really was one of the first well documentations, to my knowledge at least, where the Native culture was presented in its actual capacity of people who are profoundly wise and of an incredible spiritual, humanistic, naturalistic depth, and not just perceived as a group of people that need to be wiped out. And if you're interested in more about Black Elk, there's another book that I listened to a couple of years ago called Black Elk, The Life of an American Visionary by Joe Jackson. It's like a 22-hour audiobook you can listen to about the whole history of Black Elk. And there's so much information there that's extremely powerful to hear about him and also the Lakota culture. And really fascinating, too, that only recently Black Elk was recognized as a saint by the Catholic Church. So to understand a lot of the history and the backstory of what the Native culture went through, and simultaneously the power of the Native culture, I think is just really important for understanding anything related to what James is talking about here in the interview. This is an opportunity for us to meditate on the struggles of people and cultures around us and how we can learn to live in harmony with one another and learn to empower one another and respect one another and learn from each other, and at the same time meditate on why these things happened, are still happening, and what power we have within ourselves to make a difference and to find ways to grow together as different people from different cultures and different races and different religions and different backgrounds and different social class, and find ways to connect and harmonize in this extraordinarily trying time of this coronavirus situation, and really learn to listen to one another. We had a Lakota activist who is very well known named Teokasin Ghost Horse, who lives here in New York, come and speak at our community, and someone asked him, what can we do to help improve relationships between the mainstream American culture and the Native culture? And he said, just listen to what they have to say. Give Indigenous people an opportunity to speak and hear their story and understand where they're coming from, and don't try to impose anything, but really just learn to listen. So I hope that this interview serves as a good opportunity to activate our capacity to listen and reflect and uncover a little bit more about the struggles of Native people and also the power of the Native culture and its capacity to connect people back to harmony with themselves, harmony with each other, harmony with nature, and to reflect on how we could bring about more peace in the world and more understanding. Without further ado, here is the interview. Enjoy. Okay, good morning, everybody, and welcome to Bodhi Speak. I am sitting here, not in person, but through the power of the internet, with James Warren Flaming Eagle Mooney. And James, it's really an honor to have you here. I'm really excited to be able to hear your story in this way, and then also be able to share this with people. So first of all, just thank you for coming. Deeply appreciate it.
I'm honored to be here.
I want to read James's bio before we get into the questions here. So James was born January 3rd in Grass Valley, Nevada, California. He's the son of Ruth Aletta Bennett Mooney and Rex Warren Mooney. James is married to Linda Taylor Brighthawk Mooney. Between the two of them, they presently have 15 children, more than 30 grandchildren, and 4 great-grandchildren. James was awarded a Volunteer Service Award by President Obama in 2014. He was the first Indigenous Native medicine man from a Native American church into the Hospitaller Order of the St. Lazarus of Jerusalem, a charitable organization that has been around for nearly 1,000 years based in Malta in Europe. James is also a member and speaker of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He has worked closely with spiritual leaders from many tribes such as the Lakota, the Huichol, Yavapai, Apache, and many others. And he has won many cases protecting ceremonial work, including one against the state of Utah in the Supreme Court. once again, James, it's really an honor to have you here. I really appreciate you taking the time to come here and share your story. When I asked for your bio, you sent me a video, which is really beautiful and really well done, where you were talking about the Vision Quest and you were talking about how you first came across the grandfather medicine of peyote. And in the video, you share that peyote was the main medicine that healed you of a bipolar diagnosis. And I was hoping that you could just share a little bit about that and what that process was for you and anything else that you feel called to share about in that regard.
Well, I'm really honored that you would ask that question, because it really is not a short answer, okay? But it is a story that, in order to answer that, it will give your listeners and yourself a real understanding of what the indigenous cultures have gone through from almost for the last at least 5,000 years. You have these cultures that were first just beautiful. I mean, the original people were just, they always looked after each other. They had to look after each other. Margaret Mead made a statement not too long before she passed, but she made a statement that what was really interesting to her was that they uncovered some bones out of a cave, that the people's hips were broken at one time, but they had healed. But they healed to a point where they still could not fend for themselves. Her hypothesis is that the basic human character is to serve one another, because with that kind of an injury, that person or persons could not continue to fend for themselves. So they had to defend or be defended by their family or their tribe or whatever it is. And so I really want to portray the truthfulness of my basic belief, is that mankind is beautiful. It's loving, it's caring. But as everything goes on, there's kind of an acceptance that once somebody realizes they have a certain amount of power, it's just a human characteristic that they will start corrupting it almost immediately. And how they do that is that pride comes in. And when pride comes into a person or a culture and is the overbearing characteristic of that person, then two other things will manifest. One is greed, and another one is fear. And because the fear comes in, because they fear that they're not going to continue to make the money or have the influence that they originally had, or it'll be diluted, and that's fear. And so pride is really the fundamental challenge that we have to fend off within ourselves and as a culture. So taking that in the manner that I just expressed to you, I have been able to chart, because of people that I do know from Egypt. And Egypt has a very strong cultural, historical, and they've retained their historical background. And so that goes back to 4,000 some odd years. Well, that period of time seemed to almost delineate the matriarchal powers of loving the earth as being the mother, and started to just deal with patriarchal material. And pride steps in. So they start suppressing the matriarchs. And it's easy to do that if you're aggressive and you don't care about how you get your objectives, because a matriarchal basically are the masters of unconditional love. They're going to love you no matter what. That's the way, just ask a child, you know, a child, newborn baby, totally protected, cared for. That mother wouldn't even think instant not to come to that aid, if that, or put their life up to save that child. It's just an automatic. But the downfall to that is if you're dealing with some type of prideful, aggressive situation, it doesn't have a chance. Mm-hmm. Therefore, this patriarchal, the corruption of the patriarchal, really started and emulate itself in my mind, because of my personal knowledge of Egyptian history, really manifested itself at that time. So these things kept on going on and progressing. I can talk to you about, but it's not answering your question about the bipolar manic depressant. However, the ceremonies of the indigenous people and the sacraments that the earth has provided mankind cures everything. There's nothing that it cannot take care of the human condition. It's all there. But because of the prideful aspect of setting in, the idea of wanting to depress that knowledge, it's like when Cortez and his conquistadors, the Jesuits, the first thing they wanted to do was burn all the codices, all of the formulas of healing and everything, because they didn't want any competition to their prideful way of saying you have to believe in me in order to be ushered into God. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to destroy anything to do with matriarch. It's out of bounds. It's to the point that the sweat lodge ceremony by the indigenous people feel very strongly that environment of the sweat lodge cures everything. It's a cure-all.
Right.
And for a variety of reasons, most people that are in the healing business or livelihood of wanting to cure people of these traumatic injuries emotionally, spiritually, or physically that they have survived through, they want to heal those things. And in order to heal someone, it is a predominant understanding you've got to get them out of control, out of their comfort zone.
That's a good way to put it.
Okay. And so a sweat lodge does that on all areas of one's mm-hmm. being. All the senses are being impacted and getting you out of control of yourself. So that once you hit that area of absolutely being vulnerable to that, and you want to strive out and get more, regain more control over what is going on, you're going to reach for something new to deal with the circumstances. And when you do that, that's when healing jumps in. Okay, because then they're going to try something new. Okay, well, the Jesuits and the conquistadors brought another or some viruses that the indigenous people of North, Central, and South America had no freaking idea. Uh-huh. Because they were totally ingrained with the earth and but this new viruses that were brought in, it's not a secret that the Europeans were just filthy. They didn't believe in taking baths. And every culture, whether it was Japan or North and South America or Polynesias, I mean, they couldn't hardly stand being with these Europeans because they stunk so much. And so they brought a diseases to the Central and South America, North America, that these people had no experience to. And so they went into their sweat lodge, which they normally would do to cure themselves of a health issue. Mm-hmm. But that ended up killing them. So the Jesuits used that, saying that's an evil process, and started to say all of the benefits that was once utilized by the North and South American people. A prime example, and I'm not degrading anybody, but I'm just telling the fact. Okay, in the LDS Church, which is a phenomenal religious organization, okay, but one of them is the Word of Wisdom, where they outlaw a person to utilize tea. Mm-hmm. Holy mackerel. That is one of the major ways that a medicine person, an indigenous medicine person, instilled medicines to cure people. And so they're taking away, they took away the basic elements of the healing elements from a sacrament position away from them. Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. And the reason I know this is because I spent a lot of time with the Huicholes in the Sierra Madre mountain range. And the teachings that these people gave me were, one, is heartwarming of what they went through. The conquistadors, if they found out that you were even singing a traditional song or taking peyote, they killed you immediately. Mm-hmm. In the United States, for a Native American person to sing their sacred songs was a federal violation law.
Right.
1933, I think it was, when they finally said that that was okay. I mean, the astounding degree that prideful behaviors will take a person or a culture is unfathomable. Okay.
Insanity.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. But the thing is, a matriarchal has no defense. Mm-hmm. None. And so things just has gone haywire for at least 4,000 years. Okay. And so something happened a couple hundred years ago in the United States of America that a constitution was implemented. And that constitution was inspired by the Iroquois Confederation.
Right.
To George Washington. And it is very evident, very knowledgeable, it's known that he gained that information through sacred pipe ceremonies. Mm-hmm. Now, because Joseph Smith, the founder of the LDS Church, was truly inspired by the indigenous people in the use of peyote to formulate the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Hmm. Which is, when you start thinking about this, but let's go back to that Constitution. That Constitution was set and developed because of the extreme knowledge that the indigenous people had gained on how to live in harmony with other people with different cultural values.
Yep. Definitely.
And therefore, you look at the Constitution is nothing but a laws or rulings to be able to live in harmony and respectful of other people's differences. What? There's no other document in the history of mankind that has been adopted by a culture like the United States Constitution. Unbelievable how that came about. Now, the First Amendment is pretty clear, but there's not one of the people that signed that Constitution that was actually, or they actually owned all slaves, all of them.
Yep.
Totally against what the Constitution was set up for.
Right.
And so, you got to look at the United States as being infants. And you have a new child, right?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, he's a month old today.
You go beat up that child because it poops its pants?
No, of course not.
Of course not. Okay, United States government, it's democracy. It's going to make mistakes. It's going to, in essence, poop its pants.
Yep.
Do you beat up on it? No. You just say, oh, okay, let's take care of it. Let's go on from there. It took 100 years for the slavery thing to become a reality. Thank God with Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. Get me? But the cost of change, the painful aspect of change, caused so many thousands of people to be killed by each other, family members. That's how bad, how difficult it is for a person or people or a group of people to make a change.
Right.
So we have this country that is progressing. And when you consider where we are now compared to where we were when Washington persuaded Congress, holy mackerel, man, we are growing really good.
That's a good way to look at it, yeah.
Really, really good. Now, I'm going to backtrack because I'm staying on focus about my healing of bipolar, manic depressant, which is supposedly impossible to overcome. Mm-hmm. And when I was working in the prison system, it was a predominant understanding amongst the healers, psychiatrists, and psychologists that almost 70% of everyone incarcerated has some type of bipolar manic depressant.
And you were there. You were there working as a healer doing ceremony, or
I was a counselor. Conducting. Yeah. I was first of all, I was a cop. I worked 7 years undercover, okay? Wow. And it was one of that 7 years is probably one of the most disgusting periods of my life, because nothing about undercover is honorable. Uh-huh. Everything is a lie. Yeah, everything is a lie.
It has to be, right? So.
Oh, yeah, unless you're dead.
Right.
And there were so many hits out, international hits out on me, but they didn't know who Jimmy was. That was my code name. Uh-huh. And so, but they didn't know who I was. And that's just the way it was. I mean, I had, who knows how many people were looking out trying to kill me at that time. Mm-hmm. You know, thank heavens that's 30 years ago. And so a lot of things have happened since then. And plus, I went ahead and apologized to the inmates and told them I was undercover and I helped put some of them in there, thinking that they'd kill me, but they didn't. They ended up putting their arms around me and telling them they understood and they loved me. Wow. So that's a story on itself. But anyway, the bipolar is really a devastating disease, and that is a disease. Now, at the time that I discovered I was bipolar, the only thing they had to be able to bring the person into balance was lithium. And I progressed up to 1,800 milligrams of lithium a day, where it wasn't doing me any good. That is some indication to someone that's in that profession, knows that this guy was a history. I was a bipolar. I was diagnosed. By a psychologist, not a psychiatrist. And they worked about, my wife at that time, worked about 6 months to get me to accept to take lithium. I didn't want to take it. And I'm finding out most bipolars don't want to lose that high, because the high is really cool. And I was an international business consultant, and people made a lot of money off of me because of those highs, or saved a lot of money. And I worked on the international basis of companies in Japan, South Korea, England, United States. I was even a consultant for McDonald's. I helped set up some of their management and hiring systems. I worked for the mafia. I opened up the basic principles of some casinos. Matter of fact, at one time, I opened up this casino in Canada called Maple Leaf Village. And I only set the foundation. It was at one time the most successful Indian casino in the world. But I only set the foundation up for the tribes to start to go in negotiation with whoever was the money people and developing that. And it was Niagara Falls, Canada. But I've worked with so many unbelievable organizations. But when during that time, I discovered I was bipolar, but I had a cycle. 3 weeks on and 4 weeks, I was an idiot. So in my contracts and agreements that I would make with people, I would say I had to take three, I would work 3 weeks, and then I had to be gone for a week. And I did that for years. Okay. Some things happened, and one of the major things is that my wife died of lymphoma cancer, and leaving me with 9 children.
Wow.
And that was really devastating to me. I loved her deeply. And, but I'm bipolar. And now it's going crazy. The 3 weeks, 1 week, it's just going goofball.
Right. How old were you at that time?
I think I was 40 something.
Okay.
It was 1987.
Okay.
So I was born in 1944. 1987, I think, is when I was really out of control. I mean, I was just really history. But during this time, I got a psychiatrist. Now, when I was diagnosed with this bipolar manic depressant, I was in Hawaii. And I had, was working with a psychologist, and I think it was Dr. Redford, I believe. Beautiful woman. And then I worked with the psychiatrist, Boyd Slomoff. Now, this is quite some time years ago, and I'm sure neither one of them are still practicing. Well, maybe, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But when I got to California or back to Utah, oh gosh, I forgot the psychologist's name. But he gave me a hypothesis of what causes a bipolar manic depressant individual that will have that imbalance that can possibly take over their lives. And he expressed that there's a lot of documentation that if a child loses consciousness and a constant supply to the brain of oxygen, mm-hmm. that will set in a pattern for someone to have a bipolar manic depressant episode before their age of 18. And through the counseling of all these different people, I discovered that I first had an episode when I was about 17. No, one time when I was in grade school, mm-hmm. another time when I was in junior high school, and another time I was in high school. And then I had an explosive breakdown when I was about 1965. So I might have been 24 or something like that at that time. But nobody knew what they were. It was just that he was going through an epileptic fit or something like that. And nobody understood what, in my case, that was going on. But when he said something about a young child losing consciousness and a lack of oxygen, that all of a sudden brought something to the forefront of my mind that I had been trying to deny for my entire life.
Right. Yep.
When I was three years old, my mother was living in San Francisco, and World War II was over. My father was a part of the 101st Airborne that was in Normandy. And he was part of that group of people that parachuted in the back of Normandy and were the devastation was unfreaking believable. Mm-hmm. He ended up becoming first of all, he retired. And then for some reasons, about 1947, he reenlisted. And my mother and he had divorced because he was extremely violent and she could not deal with that. But she was in San Francisco, 19 years old, or now 21, knows nobody, is really having a difficult time. So he shows up and takes me back to live with my grandparents, who are direct descendants of Osceola, a Seminole war chief. And James Mooney, in 1918, he saved the entire American Native culture from being outlawed. He was a Smithsonian Institute ethnologist. Oh. I have both of those men in my DNA.
Powerful combination.
Yeah. Okay. Everything I'm telling you from here on out has been secured of being authentic by almost a 6-month investigation of United States attorneys and investigators. There were three attorneys and three investigators for over 5 months investigating what I'm about to tell you, or what I have started to tell you. Mm-hmm. They discovered factually I am related, a direct relationship to James Mooney. I am absolutely a direct descendant of Osceola and his escaped slave wife. And in part, they proved it by doing DNA, the federal government.
Right.
And they found African inmates here, an African, Irish or Celtic, which was James Mooney,
right,
and Native American, which was Osceola. Osceola was actually a half-breed, okay, mostly Creek. Anyway, so the story I'm about to tell you is really weird, but it's sustained by the federal government, and it is a story that I did not want to accept. When my grandfather took me back, or when my father took me back to Southern Missouri, 1947, to live with his parents, who both were descendants from Osceola. Now, what I'm going to tell you now, not many people understand this. They always think about the atrocities that have been perpetrated were upon federally recognized Indians and reservations, which is absolutely the truth. Giving them poisoned blankets filled with smallpox,
yeah,
rancid meat, all to destroy the entire American Native culture, the indigenous cultures. But this has been going on for thousands of years. So, not many people know what I'm going to tell you, but now it's going to get known really big. When Osceola was imprisoned because of coming in on a white flag of truce, they arrested him instead. He was very ill. He had some kind of a throat disease. I don't know exactly what it is, but he was really ill anyway. He died incarcerated. And in part, because of the lowliness that the United States military went through to capture him, that was the start of them defunding the war against the Seminoles. But the Seminoles were really hated by Andrew Jackson. Mm-hmm. And I mean hated, because in reality, Andrew Jackson got his butt kicked all three times that he developed the war. The first war was because of escaped slaves. And the slave owners complained to Jackson, who was also a slave owner, that these escaped slaves are a property and they're finding sanctuary in Florida. So you need to go after them. So he goes after them, and you put an African and a Native American together as a fighting person. He got his ass kicked, okay? Uh-huh. Flat out. That was called Seminole War One.
Uh-huh.
Then the plantation owners didn't know about crop migration, transference, because, and so they were growing cotton or tobacco or whatever it was, but they would grow the same thing over and over, and then it depletes all of the soil and the nutrients of the soil for that particular thing. They didn't know about crop rotation. So they said, we need some more land, so let's go over to Florida, which is owned by Spain. Mm-hmm. And let's take their land and start growing our crops from some fertile land. Seminole War II. Andrew Jackson got his ass kicked again. So Andrew Jackson don't like Seminoles. Okay. Uh-huh. So that failed. And then they got this thing. Let's just move all these Indians to Oklahoma.
Right. Trail of Tears.
So they bought Florida from Spain. And Spain called all of these renegades Irish, who were really beat up and were sought and killed for just being Irish. They would migrate to Florida because it was owned by Spain and find sanctuary. Creeks, Choctaw, Cherokees, all migrated, escaped slaves, migrated to Florida to because it was owned by Spain and they got sanctuary. Well, when they sold that land, or when the United States bought that from Spain, Spain called this in-crop of people, Indians, they call them Seminole. And when they, and so when the United States government bought it, they simply called them Seminoles. A Seminole is actually a multitude of different races, African, European, Creek, Choctaw, Cherokees. I mean, that's what a Seminole is. So my DNA shows me over 30% Native American. And so they say I'm one third Native American or I'm a half breed. Uh-huh. But if you're talking about a Seminole, I'm a full born because a Seminole is all of these ethnic things. So when Osceola died, the United States government took the women, his wives, two daughters, and his mother that were imprisoned with him, put them on a boat. It went around the Florida Isthmus, came up to the Mississippi, and they put them on the Trail of Tears. Mm. Oh. So as my great-great-grandmother's great, because I think Osceola's mother was also, they escaped off the Trail of Tears because they knew that land because they had migrated from there to go at the time of the Red Stick Wars, which I don't want to get into that, but that's where Andrew Jackson really kicked the Creeks' ass, called the Red Sticks. So they knew the lay of the land really well. And so just before they get into Oklahoma, they escape off the Trail of Tears. Andrew Jackson, because of the love that he had, or lack of love that he had for the Seminoles, placed a $200 bounty on any Seminole that you killed, cut their head off, brought it in, man or woman or child, made no difference, because the Seminole were hated because they would never, ever concede, and they never did. We're in reality. The Seminole Nation, my particular clan, which is really interesting, is still at war with the United States government. You've ever heard of the Unconquerable Seminoles or Florida State University?
Definitely Florida State University, yeah.
Yeah. Unconquerable Seminoles. Guess who supplies them with their shaft that they carry around on the horse? My particular clan. Matter of fact, one time, this is humorous, they wanted to give a spear to somebody else, to an opposing team, and so that they could have a kind of a fight of some kind, but theirs would easily break. So, just a side note. Anyway, sure, that's good. So anyway, so here's this thing on a Seminole. They're afraid to say they're an Indian. My grandfather, who is a half-breed, but looked more Irish than he did, so he could easily pass as a white person. Uh-huh. He actually fought in the Spanish-American War. My grandmother, who was Indian, and they both spoke Seminole, mm-hmm. but they didn't speak it in public, only within the family. And because of the way the Seminoles are, they conduct a yearly ceremony called the Green Corn Ceremony on a yearly basis. And people have migrated away from Florida, will come back to Florida to what used to be called Harjo Town, now called Orange Springs, Florida. And they have their ceremony. And when I attended it, it was under lock and key and armed guards. Wow. Because they will not let anybody in there because they're used to being hunted, if you know what I'm saying to you.
Yeah, of course.
So my grandfather and grandmother would travel back to the green corn ceremony in secret. And they did that once a year. And people that migrated to Canada, Mexico, they would all come once a year to tell stories about what's going on in their lives and to keep their traditions alive. Okay, well, we did ours in secret. Mm. And when we did in public, we'd adapt to whatever it is so that we would be not weird looking, you might say. Mm. A target wouldn't be put on our backs because we're simply doing their ceremonies in a manner that is accepted by whoever.
Right.
Well, anyway. So my grandfather, mind you, my grandparents, the whole community, I believe, knew they were Indians, but because they were such outstanding citizens, they protected them and just said, there's no Indians living here. Anyway, I get back there and I'm 3 years old. And my clothing was one piece of clothing. It was Levi's, a bib Levi for a little kid, because San Francisco was where Levi's actually blossomed. And so they had, my mother had got me this little Levi bib pants. I do remember. I remember laying in a strawberry field in my grandparents' property farm, laying in the back and plucking strawberries and eating strawberries. It's warm, it's nice. I have the lovingness of my grandmother and my grandfather and my cousins and stuff. I mean, I am really in an euphoric place. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, a young boy, and this I don't really remember. This is what was told to me.
Okay.
Boy came to me and says, hey, you want to play with us down at the pond? I remember feeling, oh, I'm going to have some friends. Really a kind of a warm feeling. And I do remember that. And I remember going after the young man. He must have been about 12. And I'm on top of a hill looking down, and I see these three boys and three girls all playing down at the pond. And I said, oh, goodness, this is going to be fun. I start down, and the older boy who called me pulled me, grabbed me by the arm, and screamed to the other two boys, saying, let's welcome this piece of shit Indian to our pond. And they started molesting me. One of the girls, which was my cousin, tried to separate me from them. In the process, she got thrown, and when she landed, she hit her head on a pointed rock, killed her instantly. Ooh. This woke the boys up, and they put me in the pond and held me underwater for a goodly period of time until I stopped kicking, and they took off. And one of the girls went and got my grandma. My grandma saw me in the pond. Now this is being told to me by the feds, or by my mother and by my grandpa, anyways, told to me, because I don't have any real remembrance of the girl. Well, I do too. Anyway, my grandmother pulls me out of the water and starts pounding me on my chest, screaming. And I am hovering above me. And the sound like some echo. Like it's echoing. I'm very comfortable. I'm just, whoa. What's going on, you know? And she's screaming, you're not going to die. You are going to live. You have things you're going to do. And all of a sudden, my feeling of peace, I felt this incredible pain, anguish. And apparently I vomited into my grandmother's face all the substances that was stored into my body. And I immediately went unconscious, but I was back in my body.
Right.
My grandmother, and this is what was told to me, my grandmother and my grandfather were incredibly despondent. Their cousin or their niece is dead. And they can't complain because they're Indians. And what I understand, my grand, they called me Jimmy. We have to get Jimmy in a sweat lodge. And my grandfather did not want to do that because he felt if we're caught doing a sweat lodge, we'll be burned at the stake. But in most cases in families, the matriarch will win out. And so they went to the creek that fed the pond in the middle of the night, dug a hole inside the creek bed, put a blanket over there, put a fire, heated up the stones, and put me in a sweat lodge, an earthen lodge. And what was so unique, and this is what the during the process of the United States investigators, they discovered, or I was informed, that this tradition of a sweat lodge for youth in Guatemala is the tradition that they use to bless a infant to the medicine. And Chief Little Dove, when she was interviewed, said that type of sweat lodge ceremony and our traditions of being Creeks and Seminoles is based off of Guatemala. Unfreaking believable. I still can't believe that. I mean, it's, well, let me say, it still bewilders me that these investigators found out. So they know more about me than I know about myself. I'm sitting at my computer during this 5.5 or 6 month investigation. And Robin Howe, one of the investigators, says, "You sit next to a computer, James?" Says, "Yeah." He says, "Good. Put this in." And I put it in. And he says, "Scroll down about 6 pictures." And I did. And there's a group of about 20 family members. And he said, "Who's that little boy that's known as unknown in the first row there?" I said, "Oh my God, that's me." They went through graveyards. They interviewed tribal members. They went all over. It's 5 months. 6 United States investigators, 3 of them attorneys, went all over the place interviewing people. I still have people coming to me. "You know, your defense attorneys with the feds, they interviewed me." I had somebody just do that just about 3 days ago. A fellow by the name of Joe Binion. He said, "Man, they interviewed me. And I asked them if they're going to call me for a witness." And they said, "Absolutely." And then they called me about a month later and said, "You no need. The prosecution has dropped all charges."
Wow.
Because what those investigators found out is that James Mooney wasn't lying, but the United States government had been duped into having the DEA lie to a federal grand jury saying I was fraudulent, and all these stories that have been told about me were actually true, but they lied, committed perjury,
right,
and also lied to a federal grand jury. And so the government said, "Holy crap, we now, it is proven unequivocally, the United States government has been complicit in denying the Native American Church of its civil liberties since 1918, when my grandfather incorporated the first Native American Church." So they said, "We have got to drop all the charges on Linda and James Mooney before an evidential hearing, because we cannot allow this information to become part of federal court records."
Wow. Because if it did, I mean, what would be the implications of that?
Pardon me?
If that information became part of the federal court records, what would be the implication? What would happen?
Oh, it'd undermine the whole judicial system at that time.
Well,
I mean, think about it for a minute. It is a federal law, prosecutable with life imprisonment for denying a church of its civil liberties.
First Amendment, right?
Got it. And you're denying a religion,
right,
of its civil liberties?
Yeah. You don't
wrong. You could put judges in prison for doing, for being complicit to that. So that's part. So all of this is leading up to understanding how I was cured of bipolar manic depression.
Sure, sure.
So I have this experience. My grandmother contacts my mother and says, you got to come pick up Jimmy. They call me Jimmy. Mm-hmm. You got to pick up Jimmy because his life is in danger. People here know who he is. So my mother, which did not have a great deal of money, was in San Francisco. And she called a boyfriend of hers named Walt Perkins and told him that she's getting on a plane. And when she got off that plane, she says, you want me as your woman? And Walt says, yeah, sure do. Well, you got to go back and get my son in Missouri. And so they took a train and went back to Missouri to pick me up. Mother confronted my mother and Walt, says, we want you to raise him as a Perkins. We don't want people to know where he is. But we don't want you to adopt him. So I was raised under the name of Perkins.
Okay.
Up until 1969.
Wow.
That's who I was known by. My grandmother also said to Walt, don't let him forget who he is. Don't let him forget that he's a Native American Indian. But raise him as a Perkins, but do not adopt him. So I went back to raised in California, in the LA area, primarily Pomona, California. Walt was a tremendous artist, and he ended up becoming extremely wealthy for a variety of reasons, all legitimate. He had a real issue about integrity. You never lied about that guy. Let me tell you, he did not. And that just meant transferred to me. You do not want to lie to me, is what I'm most. Okay. But anyway, he was incredible. I mean, incredible. So that I wouldn't forget who I was as an Indian, he would paint a mural above my bed of Indian shooting buffaloes with a bow and arrow on horseback. He took up archery, and he and my mother were in the top 10 of the nation as archers to help me to retain my Indianness. But in the other hand, he always belittled Indians, basically saying they're nothing but drunkards, irresponsible people. Mm-hmm. So as an athlete, and as I was growing up in high school, I honored being an Indian. I really did. I really honored it. I honored it. Okay. And I remember I was a four-letter man, varsity four-letter man, when I was a freshman in all four sports. That is football, basketball, track, and baseball. I was considered an outstanding athlete. And I remember in my junior year of football, people on the opposing team saying, "Kill that fucking Indian," because I was really known. But that was almost a standard thing for me when I was a junior in high school in football. Well, I ended up graduating, and I ended up getting married to a wonderful gal. Her name was Elaine. And I started to become interested in business. I mean, really become interested in business. Primarily the restaurant and hotel industry. To the point that I end up becoming an international business consultant to some of the most unbelievable corporations at that time around the world. Having the concept of being a drunken, irresponsible Indian does not go well with an international business consultant.
Sure.
When I was 22, no. When I was 20, my mother asked me, "Have you ever written your grandmother?" I said, "No." "Well, you know, she has written you on a monthly basis ever since you left Missouri. Why haven't you done that?" So I ended up writing her a letter at my mother's prompting saying, "Graduated from high school, I'm married, and I have a child." Well, going back about up to 69, I was opening up a hotel in Hawaii called the Queen Kapi'olani Hotel, still there. At that time, it was the premier hotel in Hawaii, outside of the Royal Hawaii. It was only two luxurious hotels, the Queen Kapi'olani and the Royal Hawaiian. Well, when I was going through the idea of being accepted top management of this hotel, they had to do an abstract or a search on my background. And they came back and they said, "Got no records of Jim Perkins. It's James Mooney." And I told them this story about, you know, that I was raised underneath the name of Perkins. And they said, "You've got to make a choice. What are you going to do?" And I said, "Well, I guess I'll take my real name." And said, "Okay, you're hired." So this international hotel, it was actually owned by Japan or a Japanese corporation. So I ended up taking on the name James Mooney, my original name. Okay. Well, I opened up this hotel and I had the opportunity to work on an international basis for this organization. But I didn't want to for a variety of reasons. So I came back from Hawaii, and this is 1969. And I came back from Hawaii, and my mother and my brother and sister met me at the airport. And they were all happy and see me, thinking that I'm kind of a cool guy. And my mother says to me, she called me Jim. She says, Jim, I got something to share with you. So what? She says, your grandmother died. It was no big thing to me. No big thing. I said, okay, Mom. So I come home and I'm pretty ticked off at my mother because of some of the stuff that I've been doing. And I was like a lot of idiots blame their mother for all their stupid things that they do. And my mother was just incredible. She was a knitter, perfectionist. She's knitting away and I'm just laying it on her for about 3 days. And finally, after 3 days of me just, she looks up at me and says, well, did you get it all out of you? I said, yeah, I guess so, Mom. And she says, well, what are you going to do now? I said, well, I guess I'll go back to school and get a job. She says, well, you better get out. But I got something I need to share with you before you get up from the table. I said, well, what's that, Mom? She said, you know, your grandmother died. I said, yeah, Mom, yeah, you told me that. Well, I was with her when she died, Jim. Huh? I says, yeah. And when she passed over, I realized in her left hand, she had something crumpled up in her hand. I opened up her hand and there was one letter that you had written. The implications of that, of me denying my Indianness, really didn't hit me until I was in my 40s. As I said, my wife Eileen, who I had 7 children with, died in my arms, as a matter of fact. It blew me away. I am now, that bipolar stuff, lithium is nothing working.
Right.
My wife's family of Eileen is scared crapless about me. So I ended up losing custody of all my children because of the fear in my mind, because of what they feared I could possibly do. Because I mean, I am bonkers. Mm-hmm. I've been hospitalized already 4 or 5 times. So I cannot work now. And this woman, her name is Linda Stone, knew my reputation of being quite a business superstar. And she got me to start doing seminars for businesses in conventions. I was so messed up, I couldn't even dress myself. They had to dress me. But for 8 hours, I could get in front of a group of 500, whatever amount of people there were, and do a good job. But then afterwards, I would just collapse. I mean, I was just sick. I was just really sick. I was so sick, I couldn't work. I had no functionality to myself at all. Linda, by the grace of God and her beautiful heart, gave me a bedroom where I could sleep. And there was a phone right next to my bed. One morning, I get this phone call. And it goes like this. I answer the phone. I say, hello. And it's a Southern accented woman's voice, which really melts me. I love that Southern voice of a woman. And she says, is this James Mooney? I says, yeah. Is this James Warren Mooney? I said, yeah. Then she said, welcome home. We have found you. They have been searching for me for 20 years. Because my grandmother and my grandfather every year would go back to the green corn ceremony and say, there's this Jim or James Warren Mooney that is a descendant of Osceola and James Mooney living in California someplace, but we don't know where he is. She started telling these stories that I've shared with you. That later have been confirmed by the United States Attorney General's office, and started me, introduced me to my suppressed heritage.
Right.
I did not want to accept I was an Indian. In my head, at the time, the reason I didn't want to accept I was an Indian, because it was not beneficial to me in my profession.
Sure.
But as I started to look into things and start realizing, the reason I wanted to deny myself as being an Indian, I didn't want to be killed. Mind you, my grandparents were born while the United States government was still financing $200 per Seminole head.
Right, a lot of trauma around that. I mean, to say the least.
Brought into me.
Yeah,
exactly. I didn't really realize that was my real fear until I started doing ceremonies. So, as she's talking to me, I'm telling her about my issue with my children, and I'm telling her about this bipolar, and she says, well, James, they've got a medicine out there, out west, called peyote, that I think will cure what you've got. So, I went to BYU. First of all, I would go to Linda Stone and say, I think this Chief Little Dove is full of shit. Mm-hmm. I could not fathom this spirituality stuff. Everything she told me was just wooey-wooey stuff. I mean, I'm a black and red kind of corporation. Are you either making money or not making money? If you're going to be productive, great. If you're not, get the frick out of here and don't let the door hit in the ass, because I got three guys that'll take your place.
Sure.
You get me? Yeah. This other stuff, this Indian stuff, man, made no sense to me. And I had stuffed everything to such a degree. And Linda Stone, by the grace of God, and she was interviewed, and that's the feds know what I'm telling you is so true. She says he didn't want nothing to do with it. He thought I had to force him. And she did. I was so ticked off at her when she wanted me to go to some ceremony in southern Utah. Mm-hmm. And I found out that I didn't want to go, because she wanted me to go, because I told her that there's this guy named Clifford Jake that does peyote, and Chief Little Dove said that maybe that peyote could cure me, this bipolar manic depression. And I said, this is all bullshit, Linda. Give me a break. It's bullshit. All of it. Peyote can cure my bipolar and manic depression. Give me a freaking break, man. I've had the best psychiatrist hospitalized, and this woo-woo boogeyman can possibly cure me with this illegal drug. Give me a break. This is idiotic. Anyway, I learned about this Clifford Jake because I went to the library at the university and I picked up every book I could find on peyote, and I found this one guy named Clifford Jake down in the St. George area that was peyote. And I told Linda that. Well, anyway, she wanted me to go to this ceremony, about 300 or 400 or 500 people. So I do not want to go. I just think this is all bullshit. Anyway, she keeps at it. There's one thing about Linda Stone. She gets on something she's unrelenting. Unrelenting. Finally, I went with her. I was so ticked off at her. I wouldn't ride in the cab. I rode in the back end of the pickup. I was so pissed off. We got down there. There's that Snow Canyon. And we drove in there. God, there's all kinds of people. And I noticed a sweat lodge. And something rung true to me about that. I saw that, and I remember I took a kind of a double take. And it was at Snow's Canyon, beautiful place. Anyway, I didn't want to be there. And so I made my camp totally away from everybody else. I woke up and I took a hike. Beautiful. The area is just gorgeous. When I come off of the hike, I realize all these hundreds of people are gathered around in a big circle. And at the head of the circle, or at the east end of the circle, there's a fire and some kind of stakes and things like that. And I'm kind of wondering, I wonder what's going on. And so I walk down, and there's a big rock between me and where this fire is. And I'm hiding behind this thing. And the way the rock was, I could stick my head off of one side and nobody could basically see me. I was kind of hidden. All of a sudden, this old Indian guy comes out, Vincent. I guess he was 70, 80 years old or something. And he just stands at the fire. And he's not saying nothing. He's just standing looking at the fire. And all of a sudden, he turns around. People are getting a little nervous. I, myself, personally, I said, oh, the old man forgot his lines. I was just so sarcastic. I mean, you know, he turns around and he walks directly towards me. And he points at me. He says, hey, you, come here. Who, me? Yeah, you. The people spread. It's about 3 or 4 deep in this circle, spread. And I walk up to him and he puts his arm around me. And he says, you're going to open up the ceremony. I said, what? I don't even want to be here. And he says, it's okay. I don't know anything about this stuff, you know? He says, okay, I'll help you out. I open up the freaking ceremony. Well, it was called a long dance. And the long dance is they dance all night. Okay. And I was taking a break at this fire. And there's about five or six people sitting there, and we were just talking while a group or other people are dancing and stuff. And we're talking, and all of a sudden I see this beautiful woman dressed in white, definitely an Indian gal. And she's just standing there. And I said, "Why don't you come and join us at the fire?" And so she does. And she sits about a foot or so away from me, a couple of feet away from me. And we're talking, and all of a sudden everybody else leaves. And I told the people that I'm really sick, and that maybe there's a guy named Clifford Jake down here that does peyote that might be of help to me or something. Well, everybody is gone except for this attractive gal. Her name was Gwen. And then she looked at me and just very quietly says, "I know Clifford." I said, "You know Clifford?" "Yeah. I'll talk to him, see if he'll get with you." So a few days later, they're closing up this big ceremony. I am now very much part of everybody, arms around each other, having a good thing. And Vincent comes out and says, okay, James, come here. So I come over there and puts his arm around me and he says, "James is a brother of mine in the medicine. He's got some words he needs to share with you."
You're like, what?
I'm telling you, this medicine is just a mystery to a guy that I was back then. Mm-hmm. It made no sense to me. And as I've grown, it still amazes me. But I don't question it for more than a few hours. Mm-hmm. Where beforehand, I'd go months on end in questioning it. So I ended up meeting Clifford. Stood about 5'6", and he looked like a shriveled up peyote button.
That's a good description.
Believe me, that's how he looked. I could go on to stories about this guy that just blow your mind, but that I'll stay on focus. Anyway, he got me into the first ceremony. I did about four of them with him. But I had no intentions. None. I just thought it was kind of a cool experience. And you know, it wasn't life-changing to me at all. I think I did four of them.
Even after the first four, it wasn't life-changing and you didn't feel... like a ship.
No, because I didn't do it with the intent,
okay,
of accomplishing anything. I did it more as just see what this is. I'll never forget it. Right. That first ceremony I did, I mean, I'm an idiot. Okay. Or at then I was a real big idiot. Now I'm just an idiot. But I remember they're passing around the peyote. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with the teepee ceremony, but they had powder. Uh-huh. And they pass a bowl with a little spoon, you put a powder and I said to myself, true story, I'm not going to let them get to me, man. I just put a tiny bit of that powder in my hand. Put it in there. I mean, my mouth just, that taste was just horrible for me. Uh-huh. Just a little bit too. That's one of the, And I asked, can I have some water? And they said, sure. And so they passed me some water. God, that was great, you know, but it was heated, but that was okay. Anyway, so I go through the whole ceremony, just taking a little bit, but drinking all kinds of water. Come to find out at the end of the ceremony, it was peyote tea, not water.
Yeah.
So they got me anyway. That's a true story. That's how stupid I was at that time. Anyway, I did four ceremonies. And then my bipolar thing is really getting bad. I mean, it's really bad. I'm actually, I think I'm at the stage I got one foot in the grave.
Right.
I am so sick. I cannot work. I cannot do anything. I have this elder from the, he was the Elders Quorum president. His name was Sean McCausland. He was also interviewed by my by the federal attorneys. And I told him I'm really sick. I don't think I'm going to be around much longer. And he came over and gave me a Mormon priesthood blessing. No sooner did he walk out of the door, within seconds, three Navajo guys show up at the door, inviting me to a ceremony in Page, which is about an 8-hour drive from where I was living. I said, yeah, I was enthusiastic. Sure, I'd love to. I'll never forget driving there. And we're coming over a plateau overlooking Lake Powell.
Right.
Lightning bolts. They're all over the place. It was just unbelievable. I mean, so magical. I cannot truly express the full ramifications of that, the beauty and the awe. I arrived there and I ended up staying all night in a hogan with this family. And this hogan, the whole family lived in this one room, this hogan. One corner was for mom and dad and the children, and then they had a guest bed for me, and it was immaculate. I mean, it was so immaculate. It's, I cannot express to you. It was almost like an army barracks, if you know what I'm saying to you. It, so organized and so, and I noticed they didn't have a toilet facility. They had an outhouse outside the hogan. And so I remember going out and I noticed everything was so immaculate. They had this raked the sand all around this hogan past the outhouse. And I came back and I said, God, you guys are really something. I mean, that it's so raked. It looks so beautiful. And the guy laughs, or the father laughs. He says, we don't do that for beauty, James. I said, well, what do you mean? He says, when you rake things really good and there's a rattlesnake, we know where he is. I mean, they were thinking. Anyway, they put up this beautiful teepee, everybody working together, nothing but joy, laughing and stuff. And the teepee's being put up. And then we, if you're not familiar with the ceremony, but the ceremony starts at sundown,
right?
Usually around 9 o'clock or an hour or so. Well, anyway, this is different, this ceremony, because I make an intention that actually reverberated Sean's blessing that I would become more imbalanced. Mm-hmm. My life would become more imbalanced. And so that's what I made a vocal intention of becoming more in balance. The water comes in at midnight, right? Well, when the water went back out, all of a sudden, I start vomiting. I mean, I am vomiting like I had never vomited in my life. And it just continued. They would come and try to get me to take more medicine. I would not take it. I said, get that shit. And I said this, get that shit away from me. Because I'm thinking that's what's making me sick. Well, they are so concerned. They're thinking I'm going to die. And they're doing all kinds of medicine work on me, trying to revive me. Well, by the time morning comes around, I'm great. I'm great. And I just, wow, this is cool, man. I survived hell. And I must be cured now.
Had you not been purging on the first four that you went to? It was
didn't purge.
So it really got deep at this time. That's what happened.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I'm telling you, I cannot truly explain to you how sick I was. Okay. Anyway, the next morning I ended up just I think I had breakfast, like, you know, I know I had breakfast, but I think I had a luncheon. But right after the lunch, I took off. Everybody didn't want me to go. They were concerned for me. But I ended up, and I got to tell you, the drive back, that 6-hour drive was like I was in heaven. I went to Clifford and said, Clifford, I'm cured. He says, oh? He says, yeah, well, tell me about what happened. And I told him how sick I was. And then he said, they offered you some peyote when you were the sickest, didn't they, James? I said, yeah. Well, what'd you do? I told him to get that peyote away from me. Clifford. Oh, I said, okay. He says, James, I've got a peyote ceremony next week in Nevada. Would you like to go? I said, sure, man. I can even help you now because I'm cured. So, okay. So I ended up going to this ceremony and making the same intention, this that I become more in balance and stuff. Right. Water comes in, it goes out. There I am again. I am incredibly sick. Worse than I was the first time, which at the time I could not imagine anything could be worse. Clifford came over, tried to give me some more medicine when I was sick. And I said, no, I don't need that now. Next morning, I feel great. As I'm leaving, he says, James, I'm going to have another ceremony in 2 weeks down in Shevitz Indian Reservation, which is in St. George area. And do you want to be there? I said, yeah, and I sure will. So I went. Water comes in, water goes out. Mm-hmm. I am sicker than a dog again. And Clifford comes back to me, tries to give me some more medicine. I will take it. So Clifford comes to my house a week or so later and says, James, I'm going to put on a ceremony up in the Cedar Bend reservation. Will you be there? I said, sure, Clifford, I'll be more than happy to be there. It was about 3 weeks, I think. He comes to me a few days before. He says, hey, you going to be at that ceremony that I talked to you about a couple weeks ago? I said, yeah, I told you I'd be there. It's okay. I thought that was weird. He never did that before, you know? So I show up, and there are no cars except for Clifford's. So this is weird. Maybe I'm too early. No, I'm not too early. Clifford put up this teepee, cut all of the willow for the peyote, for the fire, made the altar, supplied all of peyote just for me. Wow. Yetta was there, his wife, and a young boy, I guess, helped him to some degree, because he's 80 years old. And putting up a big teepee and gathering all that wood, hell, that's a heck of a lot of wood. Well, yeah. You know what it takes on to put a ceremony. So I'm sitting there just, whew. So he starts shoveling peyote into me. Water comes in, Yetta brings it in, Yetta takes it out, and there I am again. This time, I am praying to die. I'm asking Clifford to kill me. I am in so much misery. I want to die. Clifford walks around that fire, lays in the vomit with me, has a ball, and says, James, I prayed over this. I cannot force you to take it. I looked up at Clifford, said, oh, Clifford. I took that peyote button or peyote ball. I placed it in my mouth. And as soon as it went into my mouth, a peace came over me that has never left me. Yetta allowed me to spend the rest of the night in her lap. That's the answer to your question.
That's beautiful.